Welcome back to Deep Thoughts, ladies and gentlemen. So today we're going to talk about sort of the flip side of all this anti-NASA thinking that we do on a routine basis, right? We don't believe that our space agencies are telling the truth about their accomplishments. It was started for political reasons. One, to conceal the development of weapons, but the other one to defeat financially, supposedly Russia, in the 60s and 70s. It would seem there's a lot of truth to that one. But today we're going to talk about, with all of the epiphanies that have occurred both in the past and that have been resurrected because of the internet and people that remember the past and saying, look, you know, in the 60s we had it here, but then that got erased. And then the 70s we had it here and it got erased. But in the 1800s we had it here and it got erased. I want to look at an exercise in thinking behind the notion of actually traveling in space. What if the world reset and all of these, you know, fake space programs are completely exposed, and potentially we would find ones that are actually occurring that actually have a bunch of advanced technology. Now, we can't rely on that, right? I can't speak from that because I don't know of any secret space programs. We know that weapons are developed. We know the propulsion systems are developed, and we have no idea how they run. Oh, I've heard tons of rumors, and there's all kinds of YouTube videos about all kinds of stuff. But let's just take, I think, what we now know from rediscovered science, and let's parse getting off this planet and then how we would propel ourselves through space and how would we deal with what we would find in space, both from a fabric of the universe sort of void that we have. Right, we really don't know how the universe is put together. We have great theories because we can see what happens in our world. But again, we have to build propulsion systems that can deal with anything. And I mean anything. We have traditional rocketry that we understand, which definitely makes missiles fly. But when you try to escape Earth's gravitational force, you have another problem. When you try to deal with radiation belts, you've got another problem. And then when you get outside the radiation belt, I don't think man knows anything about that area. I mean, hurling a satellite into space is obviously a noble first step. I'm not sure that's occurred. I'm not. I think a lot of the Voyager footage was either artwork created by hand or it was created in a computer. Because right around the same time Voyager launches and starts sending us back pictures of things, we started developing computer-generated art. Fascinating, right? But I'm going to try to absolutely make this episode devoid of more accusations towards the space program being fake. We've already done that recently. We've done it a lot. So this is going to be, hopefully, 100% constructive conversation about what if. And hopefully I'll piece it together in a way it's a neat adventure for your mind. Some of you have a lot of knowledge in and around these subjects. You've done deep dives into the rediscovered sciences, and you're going to have epiphanies flying off this episode like electrons off a bar of uranium, so get ready. Traveling in space. There's two sides of it, right? There's the technical side to achieve it, and then there's the sort of sociological side of why do it. Typically, man says we need to find an alternative to being on this planet in case we mess up the planet. The planet goes through some cycle that is going to destroy mankind that we're unaware of. Or if there's some sort of Earth threat from space, a meteorite, some other object that comes right at Earth, and we have very little notice whatsoever. For those of you who think I might be fear-mongering a little bit of that, I want you to know that I take a staunch position against fear-mongering things from space that hurt Earth or could hurt Earth, which funds these organizations. You know, there's all kinds of tactics that people scare you into giving them money. And so that's not where I'm coming from. But I will remind you that if we were not lied to, okay, and I believe independent astronomers have confirmed this, I think within the last 20 years, right, Jupiter took a hit that was phenomenal. It was three giant bodies. I believe it was three. One theorized to be the size of Earth, slams into what we perceive as, in the northern hemisphere of the Earth, the southern region of Jupiter, and it's supposedly left spots in the atmosphere. And what was interesting is these things ran into the bowels of Jupiter, which is called our vacuum, right? It's called the big vacuum cleaner, the solar system vacuum cleaner, because it has so much gravity, it's grabbing most of the big stuff. But could you imagine one slipping by? We're on the opposite side of Jupiter, here it comes, or it's all timed out properly such that Jupiter never has any gravity pull on it. And even though we are a tiny, tiny speck in relative terms to everything else in our solar system, it whizzes by and clips us. Maybe it just clips the moon, throwing a third of the moon at the Earth. Maybe it impacts Earth. Maybe it totally destroys Earth. Maybe it hurts Earth. So these are some of the reasons why we want the control of our own destiny as a species to be able to take ourselves from planet Earth to another planet, perhaps even a moon if it could host us properly, right? Now, right off the bat, most junior scientists and sci-fi buffs know that trying to find a Earth-like planet, a Gaia-class planet, right? One that has generally the same diameter as the Earth, therefore the gravity is remotely like the gravity we have here. You realize if it's off a little bit, our current species would suffer. If it's a little smaller, we might do a little bit better, right? It has to have the perfect atmosphere. It has to generate food that we can eat. Even if we bring our own seeds, it has to have the right nitrate, soil, and acidity in the soil to grow our seeds. It has to have water. It just does. It has to have fresh water. Because we're probably not going to be able to bring a desalination plant with us. I mean, who knows? Maybe we'll have some crazy, you know, fusion device that can make anything into water. And so we could generally technically be anywhere in the universe. But we won't be happy if we don't have lush, you know, fields full of green grass to generate, metabolize the atmosphere that we need. For those of you who are Star Trek buffs, we know we're up against a prime directive not to hurt anything that exists on the planet. Do we want to find a planet with only plant life? Most plant life planets will theoretically have insects and a bunch of other things that could kill us. There's all kinds of issues before we even get to the planet that we have to factor into. Is it worth the effort for us to get into this program? I think at just a tiny bit of exploration angle, researching our own solar system is pretty much the first step that we want to do. Where the hell are we? Are we in a round ball? Are we on something else? Is it a pear shape like Neil deGrasse Tyson said? Give me a fucking break. There's been a question that's been posed quite a bit recently, which is, does a rocket engine work in space? You know, once you leave the atmosphere of which a rocket engine would use to push off, it pushes off the ground, then it pushes off the atmosphere, pushes against the atmosphere. Does it work once it's in the vacuum of space? Most physicists will sit there and say, well, of course, you're putting a propellant inside of a cone, and the propellant is pushing off the cone, so you're creating your own relative force in space. Some people wonder if that actually works. But let's start at the propulsion systems, the ones that we have today. Now, we have all kinds of different rockets, but they're pretty much the same exact mechanical mechanism. The fuel combinations change, and they refine over the years, right? But essentially goes through an engine that combusts it, falls out of a cone, it's pushing against the cone, it's pushing off Earth, and boom, we get a rocket. Now, again, today, everything seems to lose its, you know, vertical ascent very, very quickly. And then it's going on this idea that if it can just outpace the normal orbit of Earth and create an elliptical orbit, then the force of the Earth pulling on it, which is really the ether pushing on it, is going to create this crazy slingshot technique. With a little bit more fuel and a little bit more fuel, it's going to slingshot itself away from Earth. At least that's the theory that supports every claim that we've actually pulled it off, right? But there's a problem with propulsion system rockets and the whole theory of them. And what is that? Well, you got to bring your own fuel with you. Fuel's heavy if you have a leak or you burn it in the wrong way because you misinterpret something that needs to occur, the computers have an error, then you lose all your fuel and you are stuck in space going in the direction of which your vehicle last was propelled. God forbid you're doing a horrible spin, you know. So I think that the very first thing that man has to do to even contemplate true interplanetary travel before we get to interstellar travel, right, between stars, but just to get within our own solar system, if we can solve for that and we can go visit Pluto, the planet Pluto, we're going to need a whole different methodology of traveling. And I think that the biggest problem that we have, and I created an episode way back in season one, which was sort of a fun exploration of similar thinking, which is creating a UFO. There'd be a tiny bit of overlap with that, but I've had, you know, 3 more years to research new technology, to metabolize my thinking. So we're going to go from a slightly more clinical and fresh and clean perspective in this conversation. Now, for those of you who haven't seen my gravity episode, it's probably a really great precursor to this, which if you're like me, you won't go back and watch it right now. You'll watch it after this episode. You're going to get the gist of what I'm talking about here. And I have an ether episode as well. I am 100,000% convinced that the researchers such as Faraday and Tesla were 100% correct in their discovery of ether, the benign particle in the universe that constitutes all mass and energy that we perceive in the universe. Everything is made of ether, everything. In fact, everything is made of little elliptical orbits. And the funny thing is, all we're doing here is we're communicating within this elliptical orbit conglomerate, which is my body, your body, the camera, the mic, and everything. When you want to grow a flower in your backyard, what you're doing is you're simply growing an ethereal orbiting object that pleases you. You're growing the scent frequencies for your nose, so you love a rose, right? But there was a little shift in the thinking of mankind around the time of Einstein, who couldn't figure out what it was, and so he threw it out. And they created some bogus experiments to try and kill it, which are all ridiculous. They're ridiculous on levels that are crazy, but please watch those 2 episodes. Again, I'll forget to put it in the description, just like I forgot to put the moon episodes in the moon part 3, which I call part 2 in the episode. Really strange to me. I believe that if we really want to travel throughout the stars, throughout our planets, we're going to have to rediscover, re-endorse, and recertify the behavior of ether in this universe. Because it is my belief that we will, if we can find the energy systems, which I believe we probably have hidden away somewhere, but even if we have to create it from scratch, that's what we have to do. We need zero-point energy systems that can create massive amounts of energy by themselves, completely, without any stimulation from outside Van Allen belts or anything, which we could cannibalize some of the power that's out there. It's almost going to probably be a hybrid spaceship that says, look, if we have some energy flowing around the ship, then we'll use that energy. But if we're in the vacuum of space, which really isn't a vacuum, but if we're in the ethereal winds of space, we will be able to metabolize that ether through the ship, or we'll have a device inside of our ship that by stimulating it will tell ether what to do around our ship in a way that we can travel through the stars. Now, for those of you who are Bob Lazar fans, who I mention all the time on the show, he has essentially discovered the theory. Whether or not he is working on a UFO, I have no idea, okay? But he is genius enough to talk about an ethereal-based engine system, whether or not he I don't think he ever says ether. I think that's funny. He talks about creating gravity voids, which then the ship flows into. Well, all he's talking about doing is pushing ethereal winds out of the way in the direction and the side of the ship that he wants to go in the direction of, right? Why does a plane fly? Why does a bird's wings work? Because the shape of the wing displaces air pressure above the plane and creates lift. Well, that's sort of a really fluid dynamic method of explaining ether. Bob Lazar did a 45-minute interview in front of a bunch of people where he took a bunch of questions And it was pretty much stuff you could have made up before you ever saw him do the interview, and you would have been, okay, you would have been 95% correct. But the one thing he talked about was very fascinating. And it sort of gets into Star Trek-y dilithium crystal thinking, which is also interesting. Now, I'm going to give you this, what I believe to be probably a fictional account. Hey, if he's telling the truth, awesome. I mean, awesome. But it's a way to think about the problem, okay? It puts it in context for your brain. I believe he claimed that there was a new element that they had discovered, a crystal element that was inside one of these spaceships at the heart of the ship, and that when stimulated with a tiny bit of energy, it was like a piezo effect of a crystal. Put a little bit of energy in, and it creates a big energy out. And it always creates the same effect, right? You can, in a crystal, a piezo effect, as I understand it, you can put variable stimulation into a crystal, but because of its structure internally, it always metabolizes it out at a constant wave. You can amplify it, right? You can put more in, and then the wave around the crystal gets bigger, but the crystal is going to give off one effect, which is why people put crystals in their homes to calm themselves down, to get rid of radio frequencies. There is a bit of truth to that theory, if not 100% of that theory. But his theory, or what he claimed to be true, was that the craft he worked on had this element. I don't know what the physical volume size of it would be, but through stimulating it in a certain way, it was able to affect a gravitational field around the ship, creating pockets of negativity, which allows the ship to go in that direction, because essentially it has nothing resisting it. Now, to loop back on gravity for 1 second, in this show, in this deep thought show, I believe that gravity is the traditional Faraday Tesla theory, which is it's a push, not a pull. Okay? We're all held to this earth, not because earth is pulling us down. We're being pushed onto the earth by the ethereal winds that come in from space. The reason why that we actually get pulled down is that the ether actually is being stopped by the core of the earth, which I believe is a plasma core, same as the sun. Okay? By the earth getting bigger, it blocks more and more of the wind, and therefore we are pushed down. If we had wind coming up from the bottom of the earth in equal amounts, we'd be in a weightlessness situation and we'd float away from the earth. We would have never existed, right? So I believe that the colleges of the universe, the colleges of this planet, excuse me, would actually have to re-endorse ether. Just forget about anyone telling you that it doesn't exist, because that's a waste of your time. Go back and research what they had discovered in the 1800s, okay? We need to have an engine that can manipulate ether. And it's going to take some sort of technique to make it happen. Now, the idea that there's a crystal that does it is very interesting, because you get into sort of the Star Trek fictional dilithium crystal problem, where the crystals deteriorate over time as they're used, right? Star Trek's whole theory is they have dilithium crystals, and those are used to stimulate a warp field around the ship, which is basically doing the same thing I'm talking about. They're not allowed to say it's an ethereal engine, but that's exactly what it would be. And they can travel really quickly, right? Every warp factor is the speed of light, right? So warp 7 is 7 times the speed of light, right? That's why when you get into the new series that come out, you know, the new one's horrible, but the, I haven't seen it actually in a while, but the first several shows were just awful. But warp 11, you know, everyone's just looking for the new engine, how fast can it go, and that sort of thing. But our ship is going to have to displace ether so that it can achieve 100% weightlessness, basically anti-gravity, because it's controlling the factors that actually comprise gravity, right? So how do you do this? Well, I've heard theories, and I actually have friends of mine that talk to people supposedly deep in these programs, and it's really strange because they seek out my friends who are famous people for things that completely unrelated to any of this, okay? So they're just fans of their work, and they want to sit down and shoot the shit, and they're like, man, you don't even know what we've worked on and dealt with, and we're using, you know, this sort of engine to make this sort of thing happen. And they never really completely tell the person exactly how it works. I'm not sitting here with any knowledge. And when the person tells me in secondhand knowledge, it gets even worse, right? But there would be essentially two methodologies that I can think of at this point to create this sort of field around any type of vehicle. Now, we'd obviously have to be careful with the way that we create such a thing, because we need gravity as a human being to process our food, our water, and just simply be alive, right? Any of you have been hung upside down in some piece of exercise equipment, or you're hanging out at the playground when you're a kid, you immediately feel sick when you're turned upside down. It's gross. Actors that have had to do things on Hollywood sets, they can only be upside down for a few minutes before they got to get back upright again, because all the blood rushes to your head. Your whole body's built to be head to toe, not toe to head, right? So if you start to create this field within the spacecraft, then you're going to start making everyone sick and everyone's going to have issues. Zero gravity is not a good idea. Most of you have read all the papers about cosmonauts coming down after, 16 months, and their bone density is lightened horribly, and they're sick for weeks and months on end. You know, I think that low orbit's definitely capable, definitely possible. I think they've done it, and I think they've come down sick. Now, maybe they haven't. It's all a bunch of BS. But it seems like people went through some seriously bad stages in their life as a result of being in space that seem a little bit of a stretch if they're simply faking it. I mean, why fake all this ailment? Why not just say it's all wonderful, but you can't go, right? Now, if we were to say, okay, on one side of it, we've heard this outrageous theory that there's a crystal element. I want to say it's in the 61. It's either 161 or 261. I can't remember. 261 would be massively heavy. I think it's 161 or somewhere in there. You can look up Bob Lazar talking about this kind of stuff. Doesn't really matter. But let's just say there's some sort of element out there that we haven't discovered yet that when stimulated, its piezo effect is an amazingly powerful, accurate redistribution of energy such that it collides with ether. Ethereal winds that are going in every single direction all the time around us. That's why gravity is so uniform, and also why it's so weak. And it pushes this stuff away. It's sort of like an absolute Van Allen belt that doesn't let anything inside, including ether itself. Now, it may be that we can't ever tell ether to completely go away. Maybe we can only get so much velocity before we simply top out our current engine, right? Who knows? But the second technique, if you don't have some magic crystal to create this stimulating field around your ship, would be to have a power source that is simply so powerful that through moving electrons at certain levels of density, or maybe even metabolizing up to pure plasma, we're able to tell ether what to do. Now, if Earth has a plasma core and every other celestial body in the universe has a plasma core, which I think we can pretty much throw on the table as a definite possibility, then we know it works on Earth, right? We're stuck to Earth because it blocks ethereal winds up to a point, right? Now, you will notice that all vegetation in the world typically goes straight up. So I think a little bit of the ether is actually seeping through the center, or it's the dielectric force ricochet of ether hitting the core and bouncing back out. Because if you think about gravity and organic life, all of the organic life should be moss-like on the Earth, because it would grow and immediately be pushed down, right? It would just grow on the bottom of, or grow on the surface of the Earth. You know, you have protein patterns and DNA strands that could start crystallizing to create a vertical lift. But when you start looking at a redwood tree, you start looking at some serious force pushing up to allow it to exist at such heights, right? But again, gravity is a pretty weak force, so maybe just a little bit of crystallization can topple any sort of force pushing down within a certain unit of space on the surface of the Earth, right? Now, my friends have been told that the military has actually devised a non-crystal technique of actually propelling ships in anti-gravity. What they're never disclosing is the ethereal model that surrounds the theory. So they could say gravity waves or whatever, but they're really talking about ether. When you hear that we discover gravity waves, what we've really discovered is they are gravity waves, but that is defined by waves of condensed ether that is behaving a certain way due to perhaps shock waves that have happened out of various regions of our galaxy coming at us, right? I think it's real. It's just different than what they think it is, right? So what would an anti-gravity device allow us to do? Well, in short, you wouldn't have to have these launch pads like we have today. You wouldn't have a fuel system necessarily like the ones we have today. Now, maybe if the ship is, if the engine on the outside of the ship is lethal, if you get close to it, because it's disturbing so much ether that if you're standing next to it, it just shatters who you are. It just literally obliterates your body. It obliterates the holding mechanisms around the ship. Then you have to be extremely careful, right? Now, there's also another theory. When you get into ethereal patterns of energy and stimulating energy in general, you get into a different model of propulsion. Our thought is always fuel inside of a cylinder that falls out of, or some sort of canister or cylinder container that falls out of a spout that's then routed in a certain vector to create lift, right? There's a lot more to it than that, but that's your basic model. Now, how many of you have bought a television in the last 2 years where there's no speakers on the television at all? And the surface of the television is now the speaker. New Sony televisions, the new OLED televisions, which are phenomenal, they are the speaker. And they actually shape, they actually curve the speaker a little bit in one direction such that it focuses the sound towards the sofa of which you're probably pointing the TV at. It's fantastic. So no longer do we have speakers. Well, that's a pretty phenomenal twist. If you were to bring that television back to the 1970s and set it up and show somebody, they would freak out, right? Where's the speakers? Well, the television is a speaker. What? Yeah, you know, I mean, what is a speaker? It's a bladder that vibrates. Well, we're now vibrating the entire television. Holy shit. Yeah, see? Cool, right? Ironically, think about the shape of a speaker being sort of a conical device being translated into a surface. Well, imagine our ship itself is made of a metal that is able to carry the wave that the engine itself is putting out. It is the electrical sort of event horizon of the beginning of whatever algorithm, some sacred geometry algorithm. You know, you put sand on a speaker and you play a certain wave and it turns into those sacred shapes, right? We would have some sort of algorithm on the outside of our ship that would take this stimulation and create perhaps a more of a an absence, an egg shape towards the left, towards the right, towards the top, towards the bottom. Maybe you want to totally hold still, you just hover it in all directions. And it just simply stops, right? Like an anchor in space. If you want to go in a particular direction, you see a moon, a planet, a star, you just simply keep creating that wave in front of your ship. Now, I'm going to throw some assumptions out there, just some little guesses out there as to how this might actually work, if we're able to create such a thing. And again, I've been told that, I was actually told, and it sort of made me laugh, that the Mercury engine that you will see in the first episode of Iron Man, the movie, the first installment of that movie series, that the military actually created that engine and that they're 20, 30 years beyond that engine. That was the last sort of big claim I heard, which is sort of funny. It's like, okay, whatever. But the idea is that if the universe is comprised of this wind, and the wind is absolutely everywhere, and if gravity waves are real, then the very stability of space itself is actually a variable. Wherever you are in space, it's not unified necessarily, especially if there are waves. And it makes complete sense, right? When you look at a still pond or a still bathtub or whatever, where the water is just not moving, it's beautiful, right? There's not a single drop coming in anywhere. But then you put a drop in there, you get a bunch of ripples. That would be a star exploding, something moving through space. We know all of our planets move through space if they are truly out there, and the moons go around them. So at all times, it's affecting the ethereal density and distribution of ether, which creates the negative pockets of ether, which creates the gravity between a moon and a planet, right? So the moon is blocking a bunch of ether between us and the moon, which keeps it locked to us, right? We're also blocking a bunch from the behind the Earth that would normally be hitting the moon and pushing it away from us. So we're pulling towards it, and it's pulling towards us. But it's actually a push because it's due to negative pressure between two objects in space. With a ethereal, diffused, non-positive, non-negative particle, which when it starts to orbit and ricochet, you get dielectric and magnetism, which then when they collide with each other, you get electromagnetism. Again, go see the gravity episode for all the details. Now, there's a lot of volatile things in space as well. And perhaps the ethereal density gets really intense when we're in certain things like perhaps a Van Allen belt, right? What if the Van Allen belts are, I mean, they're obviously made of ether, if ether exists, and they would be extremely dense. And it would be sort of like walking, the difference between walking through your pool, if it's all shallow, right? You walk from one end to the other. It's no problem. Your body can outperform the water's force. And then it's the difference between going through the Mississippi and trying to swim straight across, because it's kicking the crap out of you and knocking you downstream, right? So whatever engine we create has got to be unequivocally infinitely powerful to overwhelm anything that we might run into in space, right? Now, if ether exists, we know that various bodies that are bigger are going to create more negative space around us, more negative pressure around us, and they're going to suck us in. We're going to be hit from behind, less hit from underneath where the planet is, and we're going to get pushed towards it. So at all times, we have to have an engine that can create this void that we can overcome any ethereal winds in space, no matter what. Now, there's a big scare in the scientific astronomy community, cosmology community, about black holes, right? Theorized, I believe, in the 1770s, and it was rebirthed later in the 20th century. And it's become a lot of great fodder for science fiction television shows, several movies, etc. Stephen W. Hawking made a ton of money off of it, right? And of course, this is the idea that mass, because in their model, okay, ether doesn't exist. It's this mysterious phenomenon, right? Gravity is a phenomenon still, but they so know what it is, right? You can calculate gravity really well. That it, the more mass that gets together, it starts to condense and condense to the point it gets so intense that even the verbal reaction called light can't escape it. And there's this event horizon where when you're on the inside of the event horizon, you don't see anything from the outside. When you're on the outside, you see whatever the hell you see, right? It could be super bright, could be various shades of super high frequency light, who knows, right? You know, I did a lot of research in black holes and wrote some pretty gigantic papers for friends in school, of which they got straight A's on. And when I was following it in the late 80s, early 90s, it got fully deprecated out of existence by Hawking, who was basically writing papers saying it can't exist, it will diffuse itself, it will create super heavy elements like helium-23 or something before it totally disperses. It'll never be a round object, it'll be a disk, but the disk then starts to collapse in the center and it creates these huge spouts above and below and it'll diffuse. It can't exist. And it was only supposed to be capable of being created out of a mass 4 to mass 12 star, somewhere in there. But they then said, oh, but a bunch of black holes could get together after they've created themselves, and so you could have a gigantic one, it's going to swallow up the universe. And it was sort of like a little horror story for a nerd, you know, going to bed at night thinking that a black hole could just show up in your solar system and swallow the whole thing up. Maybe, but I'm not convinced. Then all of a sudden, like 20 years later, it shows up. The theory shows up again. I hear my friends telling me like they fucking know it exists, right? Never seen one, never a photograph of one of any kind. And they said, well, you know, there's a black hole at the center of the galaxy. I'm like, oh yeah? Why? Because someone sold that to you because you can't ever go to the center of the galaxy, so you fucking just automatically believe it's there. Oh, well, it's under pretty good advisement. It's like, please. That's one thing we have to turn off in this universe is BS theories that we then have to waste time and money on, you know. But our ship is going to have to its best ability, being able to counteract anything of that nature, something of amazing pressure, such that we can escape some huge gravity-based object. Could be a gigantic star that's 1,000 times bigger than our star, and it's just pulling everything in. What if we want to cruise past the center of the galaxy? Well, because the center of the galaxy exists, I think, if that's what those band of stars are up there. If all those photographs of, you know, spiral things in space are real and not some illustration, which they very may well be, right? But now let's move past propulsion. We beat that up quite a bit. How do we navigate through the stars? Say we have this ship. Now, if we navigate through our solar system, probably pretty easy to get back to Earth, even though it'll freak us out when we see how tiny the Earth is once we get to Jupiter, once we get to Saturn, all these different planets that are supposedly out there that we can see through telescopes, right? They do exist through telescopes. Man, I've seen them with junior telescopes that are 10,000 power telescopes. I've seen the rings of Saturn with my own eyes in the back of my buddy's house. I've seen Jupiter with my own eyes. So there's something out there, and it's round, and it definitely has gas surface to it that definitely takes a circular shape. Okay, for anyone thinking that there's some other thing. So something's out there. But when we want to leave our solar system, what are we going to do? And I know what all the Star Trek people say. Well, we just look at the stars. The stars are the ultimate map of the universe. Okay. Well, what are all of our star maps based on planet Earth? They are based on looking from the surface of the Earth. You find the North Star, you can find the Southern Cross, the Big Dipper, all that good stuff, right? So when you're trying to find your way on planet Earth, you can look up, look at the Big Dipper, find the North Star, and you know which direction you're walking in, generally, right? Depending on which hemisphere you're on. But what if you're in space and you're hauling ass? Who knows what speed you're going? Maybe you are going the speed of light. Maybe you're just going super duper quick. Now all of the stars are going to potentially start shifting a little bit. The closest ones will take the tiniest shift. Now the beautiful thing is that stars are, if they're truly stars up there, they're really far away, so they don't shift much. They don't parallax much. Because they're so far away, you're not moving that much in space to have it change position. But now, I don't think this conversation is going to be about just traveling the solar system, right? I don't think there's any body in our solar system that could support our life. So one of the things that we're going to run into, just to pull back for 1 second, is we're going to be kind of bored. We're going to be fascinated, and we're going to be bored at the same time, that all we can do is look at a lot of these surfaces, right? Because they're so hostile that unless we created some sort of, you know, gravity suit where it basically insulates us from winds that are going 1,000 miles an hour on the surface of Europa or something, we're going to have a hard time moving around and looking around. So it's going to be a lot of probing. Maybe it's driven by human beings. But we're going to have to come to grips with the fact that man's probably not going to set up a lot of bases on foreign planets, maybe the moon, maybe on Mars, if it's truly there in the way that we have seen it portrayed through probably Terrigen renderings. But will we really set up a colony on a planet that doesn't have the proper gravity to keep the human body sound? Well, we'd probably have to take our engine and modify it to create some sort of relative gravity that matches our gravity such that we feel like we're at home. We're going to have to bring everything that we need to survive, including the seeds, the soil, everything. Or we're going to have to create machines that can create this for us, right? That's a tall order, and it goes way beyond the order of creating our own spaceship. I think it's going to be easier to create an anti-gravity spaceship to travel the stars than some sort of machine that can take, you know, rocks and make it soil. You know, I mean, maybe at some point we can pull it off, but we would have to replicate 100% the atomic composite of all the things that we need, right? I think atmospheric systems are probably pretty easy to create. It's pretty basic components that we breathe. Again, if we have an anti-gravity ship, we got an anti-gravity system. We have a gravity system for us on anywhere we go, right? So that's nice. Our ship is going to need artificial gravity inside the ship, right? Underneath the floor plate. It just is. So we're going to have to divert some of that energy down below and create an artificial pull through negative energy, negative distribution of ether to hold us down to the plate. And we're going to have to survive in space for a long time, depending on how fast we can get this ship to go. What if gravity waves are real, and there's microgravity waves? Gravity waves exist on every single frequency that we could possibly imagine, let's just say. Well, any of you have gotten in a boat, and you ride on a lake that's still, you can haul ass in your boat. The second someone else cuts the line in front of you, or it's a really windy day, you start hitting the chop. What happens? Well, your ship doesn't go as fast, does it? And it really takes the brunt force of all the waves that you hit. Boom, boom, boom. Well, if our engine has a certain level of power to push ether away to create these voids so that we can propel our craft in whatever direction that we want, it should be safe to assume that this technique is pushing ether away. It's hitting ether and saying, go around, go around. Well, if either gets more dense, more quick, more powerful, there's been an explosion you don't even know about, and this big giant tsunami is coming at you. Imagine us being kicked completely across the universe by this wave, to the point we can't stop and we can't control our vehicle, and then we hurl into whatever's in the way, right? A meteorite, an asteroid, a freaking planet, a moon, a sun, etc. And they're all pulling on us saying, come to Papa, right? Because it's saying, I've created a huge negative pull towards me. Let's go, right? So would man get out there and do him by himself first? Risk getting so deep in space that we can no longer figure out where the hell we are. If we start traveling the speed of light, now the universe seems to be, if all the science is not completely bunk, it's so freaking big that you could go 10 times the speed of light and you'll be traveling for years to get to the next star. Now, when I was a kid, they used to say that Alpha Centauri was the closest star. Even Sid Meier's made a game that was the sequel to Civilization, which was awesome, by the way. And you took that spaceship that you built at Civilization, you went to Alpha Centauri and you lived there. It was awesome. But even if you're going 4 times the speed of light, it's still going to take you 1 year to get there. Isn't that phenomenal? 1 year. You have to bring all your food. You have to take care of yourself. You're going to have to not go crazy inside your ship, which means it needs to be probably big enough that you've got enough space that you're not in some teeny tiny capsule, which means the bigger the hull of the ship, I'm assuming, the more energy you're going to need to create this wave that we're talking about. So the energy system that we have, I think, needs to have an exponential factor to it. It's going to be easy to dial in near infinite power. Or if we have this crystal technique that Bob Lazar is lamenting at and probably took from Star Trek, if he's not telling the truth, then we're going to have something that doesn't deteriorate for the duration of our trip, right? The crystal can never go away. You can't break easily, right? And we put in like an 8-volt battery, or was it 9-volt battery, and the thing creates enough energy for us to be in space for 100 years traveling at, you know, 100 times the speed of light. So we can get anywhere we want to go. Now, if we were ever to get to these massive warp speeds, warp 10 or whatever, and we're traveling our galaxy, we're not going to get out of the galaxy at warp 10 anytime soon. If we do, we might find ourselves in a void of absolute boredom, and we'll probably kill ourselves before we get anywhere. We have to go like warp 1,000 to get to the next galaxy in any decent amount of time for the human psyche to figure out. Or, as some of you sci-fi people are already thinking, we're going to have some sort of human stasis technology, which is unrelated to any of the advancements I'm talking about, where we actually slow down time for human beings, right? And you might get out your general relativity or special relativity and try to create some sort of theory there. Be careful stepping into Einstein's ideas to accomplish anything. Again, you do live in a world that's devoid of any Einstein patents. You are in a world of Tesla patents, which you probably don't even know who that guy is, unless you're one of us, right? But unless mankind bumps into another alien race that likes us and says, oh, here's the star maps, and here's, oh, well, we'll build a little API from our computer to your computer. And what kind of plug do you have? Oh, yeah. We've got the USB 42 port, you know, we'll make you a little USB 3 converter or whatever. We will let you know where everything is in space. You never get lost. Well, until we find those aliens that are so willing and able to share their information, we're going to have to real-time capture everything that changes in space so that we can rewind our trajectory and get back to Earth if that's truly our goal, which I'm dearly hoping that would be the case, right? So imagine if those systems were to go faulty. Can those systems actually sense light through our system that is actually blocking all ether? The answer is no, they can't, because light is a factor of ether traveling in a verbal concussion reaction in a wave of energy that we register as light in our brains, right? So you're never going to get it inside your ship or get it to hit a sensor unless somehow you insulate this wave such that it can actually bring a little bit of light in to hit a sensor. We won't see where the stars are. Maybe there's some more advanced technology where we could actually study gravity waves through some interpolation, right? For those of you who've ever used sonar cameras and robots, there's always interpolation of the frequency bouncing. You put 4 or 5 little eyeballs on your robot and it's sending out all these audio signals. And they do it with lasers now too, but they're a little harder because they're tighter frequencies. But there's all kinds of beautiful algorithms to figure out what obstacles are in the room with the robot based on acoustic differential algorithms. It's amazing. So perhaps we take that technology, move it up into the concussive reaction of ether to say, I feel like we got a big giant planet over here. Oh, there's Jupiter right there. You know, it's this far away because this is how these waves of this magnitude hit us and vibrate our ship. Maybe that's one of the ways we do it. Now, I know that there have been tremendous theories that kept Einstein very employed, such as wormholes, the Einstein-Rosenbridge theories, where the fabric of the universe has twisted and turned so much so that we could penetrate the fabric of the universe in such a way that we sort of hyperspace from one place to another. Well, the idea is that, and my problem with this whole theory is that, it's all on paper, and it's cute and it's interesting for the mind to think about, but we are made out of the fabric of the universe ourselves. And one of the huge anomalies of playing with ether in the universe of any kind is that imagine you turn on your spaceship. You figure out a way to displace ether in some little mechanical device in a laboratory. It's microscopic. It's like sort of CERN Hadron Collider tininess, right? And then you try to build, something the size of a shoebox. And you put a few little G.I. Joes in the center just to see what would happen. And you turn it on, and the box actually follows a pre-programmed path. It flies around the room, and it lands. But you open the box up, and all the mass inside has obliterated into nothing. Or maybe it's a big ball of plasma that then shocks the crap out of everybody in the room. Why would that occur? Well, if you're going to mess with all of the ether outside your ship, then you're sort of messing with the very bloodline of your existence, ether. Ether running through everything that we experience today. The entire time you've been alive, you've had ether flowing through your body. You are made of it. Everything you've ever consumed, eaten, excreted, the storms that you experience when you go outside, your pillow at night, it's all made of ether. So if you start playing with the introduction of ether into your ecosystem of existence, basically policing, hey, I don't want any ether from this side of the ship, right? Maybe it's not absolute. Maybe a certain amount comes through. We're probably going to have to figure out the science of saying, okay, the human body needs this much refreshing ether to continue to exist because we are not a stationary object. It is my belief that we have, that our atoms are constantly refreshing. It's orbital patterns of ether, which make up all of the sigma 5 designations of like protons, neutrons, electrons, etc., are all constantly renewing. Okay? So we're probably going to have to figure out how to counterbalance the inside of our ship. That could be that we then regulate it with our algorithm. Again, let's say we have a gravity plate that's pulling us down. We have anti-gravity outside. Some, you know, maybe a big portion of the ship, 2/3 of the ship, is actually being hit by ether. We want it to push us on the backside, right? Push the bus forward, that kind of thing. Maybe we can cannibalize that ether at any one point in time. But what if we want to stop our ship? We want it to completely balance out on the outside. Don't push us in any direction because we want to come to a complete stop. At that point, we have blocked all ether going through our ship. What are we made out of at that point? You see how it works? We may actually have to actually create some sort of siphon into our vehicle at all times. Simply getting to a general approximation of being stationary. Then there's communication. We probably wouldn't want to put a ship in space that we couldn't communicate with. And I'm jumping ahead with human beings being in this spaceship. It should go without saying that we would probably create hundreds of probes that use this technology. No human flesh in it at all. We just want to kind of see what's out there. And we're going to use anti-gravity systems to pull it off. This exact ship with no human beings inside. Now, everything I've talked about has to be accounted for anyway, right? Gravity doesn't really matter. You don't have to do the gravity plate for a robot AI inside the system taking in all the data. But if you don't give that construct of a machine its etheral supply on a routine, you know, nanosecond to nanosecond, it's going to cease to exist. You're going to have a problem. You're going to scramble the inside of the box, right? There was an interesting fictional spaceship in the series Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy called the Starship Heart of Gold, and it had inside of it the infinite improbability drive. For those of you who've read the story, it's absolutely hilarious. But what it talks about is once you turn the ship on, the ship is in every conceivable point in the universe at the exact same moment, and it simply picks where it wants to re-show up. And what's interesting about the story is it locks itself into the galaxy. Zaphod Beeblebrox is the president of the galaxy, and he can't figure out how he became the president because he sort of knows deep down inside he's a complete loser, as much as he's a total narcissist. He knows he wasn't qualified to be the president of the galaxy, so he wants to find out how he became the president of the galaxy, which is sort of an homage to the way that leaders are selected, you know, in this day and age, right? They're not elected. Hopefully that's changed in the recent history here. But if we could figure out a little capsule, some sort of device where we could have all of the data that we could possibly drag out of the universe, every attribute of measurement, from heat to ethereal density to planets and stars and moons and all the other objects out there, and we can sense them before we run into them so we can move around them. And this engine has the exponential factor that we're talking about. It can move 1 inch per minute, or it could move to the next galaxy in the next second. It has that capability. Well, one, you're disturbing space at the same time you are traveling with the system. Remember our boat analogy. When someone cuts a line in front of you with their motors blasting, you know, if you're on shore on Noodle or something drinking a beer, you know, here comes the wave and everyone's popping up and down. If you're on the shore, all the boats start slamming into the dock. It's a huge pain in the ass. Well, we probably want to make sure that our engine is fairly well balanced with the universe, because we don't want to be creating gigantic waves that might be hurting other parts of the universe. Maybe those waves grow bigger because they bounce off something else and it starts to become an exponential problem. So we have a responsibility as we travel, don't we? We don't want to tear everything up. We want to look and come back home and report what we found. Now, for the objective of saving mankind, we're definitely going to have to go off in multiple directions at all times. We need a vehicle that can travel and discover these places where we could perch for a little while. We have to figure out how much of humanity we want to save if we're going to go in that direction. Do we save 1 million people? Do we save 10 people? Do we save 10 billion people? And how will we do that, right? But we're going to have to bring all of our earthbound needs with us and try to find, again, a Gaia-class planet that's going to have pretty much everything that we have on this planet. And hopefully not another intelligent life that says, get the hell out of here, this is ours, right? It's interesting, the second that man were to come together and say, look, I've got this technology from 1960. I found this thing from 1890. I got this, that, this. And we weren't inhibited by oil companies and other, you know, governing bodies that are terrified of us gaining control over our own lives. And we actually did come together and we started building this ship and we started figuring everything out. We actually could do estimates where we said, you know, I think in 10 years, we're going to have this thing licked. The spaceship itself is going to be able to sustain computers. It's going to be able to sustain humans, both. It's going to have enough room that it doesn't matter how big we build it. We could build it on Earth. We could build it on Earth and then just lift it into space with its own engines, right? It could be the size of a city. It could be the size of a state if we could simply construct it, right? The second that we achieve that goal, then we have to go through all of the fictional scenarios, all the scenarios that have been fiction up to this point, of our responsibility in the universe, right? We have to devise a methodology to search for a needle in a haystack. Yes, they tell you that there's, I don't know what the count is, several hundred planets that they think they found in space that could sustain life, because we've done these spectrograms of all of their light coming off, and we think we've seen oxygen and water and all this other stuff. Whether or not we've actually done that or not, I don't know. I hope we have. It's funny how these things are discovered, but the public is never invited to come take a look. Isn't that interesting? When I was a kid, I think I mentioned this in one of the episodes a long time ago, when I was a kid and they would run experiments, like when they supposedly crashed sensors, probes, down into the bowels of Jupiter, like 20 plus years ago, probably not that long ago, but they did the press conference, and this guy said, we are going to rewrite the book on Jupiter. The data we got back is utterly phenomenal. Okay, where's that article? Where's the results of that data? I haven't seen anything. No one said, I haven't seen the headline news around the world that Jupiter's got, you know, cheesecake at the center. I've not seen anything from those missions. And I asked around some of my NASA buddies at the time, and I said, what's the deal with them? You know, that they run these probes out there, and the one that comes up and listens to the sun and then comes down and crashes in the desert. Like, why does it take so damn long to get the data to the public? The public is financing all this research, but we're the last ones to know. And in most cases, we're never told what's going on, right? Like the Project Orion that refuses to tell us how lethal the Van Allen belts are, because they're probably massively lethal, right? My buddy just laughed, and he goes, you know why? He goes, he said, we weren't in the conspiracy world at this time, but he said, because these scientists want to hoard everything. They want to name everything after themselves. And I thought, wow, there needs to be some new policies passed, right? Real-time data back to the citizens. Just a stream of data with tools to analyze it. Whatever tools they're using. Imagine with all the internet people out there, which are called the autists, the one that find everyone who's ever lied about anything. They dig in your past and they figure you out. Politicians and celebrities mainly, musicians, all that kind of stuff. You put them on this data, creative right-brain thinkers that are also massively left-brain thinkers. I'm thinking that the public would come up with so much more data interpretation, potential theories that we don't have in our school books today. The mecca of explosion in scientific thinking around the world would be phenomenal. And like I always say on this show, some five-year-old's going to look at the data and go, oh, it's like this, boom, 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 boom. And the room's going to go, what? You know, and the little girl goes, yeah, you haven't even checked this out. Look, it's right there in front of your face. Because she's not inhibited by a bunch of doctrine and paradigm to constrain her thinking. She hasn't been told you can't travel faster than speed light. She hasn't been told these bogus theories that ether doesn't exist and all this other stuff. But if we start raising our kids with all the information, who knows what the world could turn into, right? But how funny would it be that if whatever space organization we might come up with that we believe would tell the truth and would have this ultimate transparency, it's literally founded on a platform of transparency. In fact, we put international felonies down that, you know, you can be in jail for the rest of your life if you're caught blocking the transparency of information to the people intentionally, right? For your own benefit or whatever, right? You're selling secrets to somebody or something, right? If they have this beautiful foundation, we sit in boardroom after boardroom after boardroom, cannibalizing all of the fictional stories we've ever written about space travel. I would say Star Trek would provide 99% of the DNA for how to handle space travel. All these fictional scenarios of running into planets with viruses that are killing off one race while the other race is okay. Do you save the one that's dying? Is it survival of the fittest? You know, old X-1 episodes from the 50s. For those of you who missed the old radio series from the 50s called X-1. There's also 2000 plus that preceded that. They've gone through these theories. It's amazing how long ago we've been thinking about. Think about all the Asimov books and Heinlein books and all these Arthur C. Clarke books, where they've parsed the social impact of our responsibility of traveling the universe. It's fascinating. These policies need to be decided on as a human race if we can ever create the ship, right? Now, I think very few of you will take this tact, this other angle that I'm going to mention here. But I know that people are out there and they think, well, I'm sure that if this is possible, NASA would have already done it, right? A lot of you will laugh, and you should laugh, a hearty, hearty laugh. It boils down, in my opinion, to the following reason why information isn't freely distributed to us that might get us to this point. The reason why ether was erased from the scientific books in Einstein's era. One, I think he was an idiot to begin with. I think he was truly a Peter Sellers in being there. I think he was completely a fraud. We'll do that episode this season. I know I promised it last season. We're going to nail him this season. I mean, he did some lectures. He did some talks. So he understood at least what he was pitched. He could repitch it to other people. But again, he was at such a theoretical level. I'm just not convinced that it's proof that he was a genius. But now think about it. How many of you grew up in a household where you had a pretty strict household. And in your brain, you conceded to the fact that you were under 18. And if you're under 18, you can't do anything about your life. You have to go home to your parents' house and follow their rules. Now, legally, that's still the case, unless you somehow divorce your parents under some pretense. And so you adopt the paradigm until you're 18. And then when you're 18, you get this beautiful ability to leave your family's home. If you have an abusive parent, you get away from them. If you just simply, you just feel it in your soul. You feel like, man, I know what I want to do with my life. That was me as a kid, man. I moved out at 16 and it was like I ran my life after 16. I pretty much ran it from about 13 and up, but I still lived in under my father's home until I was about 16. And I just popped out and it was just like euphoric to control my universe. I made a ton of mistakes, don't get me wrong, but it turned out okay in the end. Now, your parents are trying to do the very best they possibly can for you, which is why, obviously, we don't always understand what they're trying to do when we're young, and we wake up when we're 25 or so, and we go, oh, geez, I was a little bastard, wasn't I? Yes, you were, but you turned out okay. I'm glad you worked it out. But we know that there are groups in the world, and I won't go off on a terrible stint in this direction, but it's something to do with why I think technology is coveted the way that it is. There's two layers of it, of course, right? There's economic benefit and control. You know, you have your social mobility in the world, which means you can traverse through the social layers of the world, the class structure of the world, meaning the richest people in the world and the poorest people in the world. And if you're super duper wealthy, you can go back and forth. You can go visit Jamaica ghettos and you can go to Monaco and toast champagne watching the F1 race, right? That's full social mobility, generally speaking. But we got to layer people over that, don't we? And they control a lot of things in this universe, universe called our planet Earth. And if we have the ability to leave planet Earth, then we no longer have this controlling force on top of us, and they no longer have the minions to control, which means, hey, what if someone was a queen and they needed their clothes cleaned, but no one wanted to do that anymore because they're like, screw you, you don't control me. And she says, I'll give you money. And they're like, I don't want your money. I got plenty of money. My dignity alone will prevent me from helping a person like you, a person who thinks they're higher than me, a person who can't even have crimes put against them, can't be charged with a crime. Nice job you did there. Well, that's over now. I'm going to Mars. I'm going to planet whatever, Xenon. Oh, that's a problem, isn't it? How many of you saw the movie in 1988, I believe it was 88, called Total Recall with Arnold Schwarzenegger in it? Now, I won't go into the premise of the movie that much, but he went to the planet Mars at some point. And when he went to Mars, he found a whole society of people that were working to mine some sort of minerals out of the bowels of Mars. And there were pretty much, it looked like, about 90% of the people were sort of peasant miners, and 10% of the people started to divide up into your sort of aristocracy there. And there was one guy that ran the entire mining company. And they kind of played him off as the guy that owns the entire mining company, probably as a board of directors or whatever, right? But they only could get to Mars. One, if you had a ton of money, you could get there on a vacation, and then you ran the tourist track. But if you wanted to live there, you pretty much had to either go into the ghettos of this place and become some sort of like Deadwood, you know, settler on Mars, or you had to be a miner. A person who mines stuff out of the ground, which means you had a blue-collar job, and you had to answer to whatever they said, whatever the policies were. And so they co-opted Mars in this movie. Before any human beings got to migrate there, they put a giant corporation there. They controlled everything, including, towards the end of the movie, you realize they control the air that everyone breathes, right? Its quality of its air, whether it was filtered or not. The rich people had filtered air, and the poor people had bad air. And the people that had to breathe bad air in the 100-some years that it took to colonize that place, they started mutating, and they started having interesting side effects to their mutations, right? Seeing the future and all kinds of wild stuff. Well, if we're going to build a new space agency, if we're ever going to conquer foreign soil, then before all of this co-opting occurs, one of the things we're going to have to build into the policy is, what is the policy of conquering foreign land, foreign territory? If the public itself paid for the program to get us there, then it's a public asset, right? But if someone comes in and donates $2 trillion to the program and pays for the conquering of a particular planet, they may say, look, I own that planet. You're not allowed unless you follow my rules. And we start creating little, you know, micro or maybe even macro monarchies on all these different planets, bringing all of their workers, and then it starts creating a class structure, and you have total recall. These are things we have to think about if we start traveling through space. Now, why do this episode? Well, one, it definitely gets through some of the scientific, it puts forth the notion of certain scientific theories that are on the table right now that have been on the table for over 150 years. The existence of ether and what you can accomplish if you could dominate ether, if you could figure it out, right? One, we got to figure out again what we're made out of. We have to redefine every piece of atomic construct that we think we know exists and find out that there's a subatomic particle that's called ether that has no charge. Its behavior and its movement through our macro view gives it the idea of a positive or negative. It's simply its rotational behavior when it starts to bang into each other in this big giant thing we call the universe. But the more important thing, in my opinion, is not necessarily the technology, because I don't want to limit your brain by anything I've said in this episode. Hey man, if you can make a ham sandwich, get us into space, I'm all there, baby, right? I prefer less mayo, more mustard on mine, but for me, the more fascinating element is the social element. And it's both an extroverted view of how would we interact with others and how would we dominate undiscovered land again, because we haven't had that privilege in a really long time as mankind. Everything's discovered now. Everything. A little island here, whatever. A backyard you haven't walked into in a few years. But for the most part, it's all been discovered, right? And then there's the introverted policies of, okay, if this particular space organization is able to accomplish that, then it's all going to be coveted by these nerds in the organization. They're not going to be transparent with the data. They're going to possibly go off to a paradise where they send us off to some volcano planet, right? We don't want private sector development of space before we've had a chance to develop in the public sector, in my opinion. I think it should be just our general rule that we actually do it as a public sector thing. Remember the big story arcs that kept reoccurring in the Star Trek series? Once they started the television series in the late 80s, early 90s, we got Starfleet. Starfleet was, I don't think, ever mentioned in the movies or in maybe in the movies in the 80s, but I don't remember any scenes for that. It just existed. You know, Captain Kirk's out there messing around. I don't believe they even had their prime directive back in the day, right? If you saw a green chick, it was on, baby. But by the time the 80s series came around, there was, you know, the Vulcans showed up when Zephyr and Cochrane did the warp drive experiment. And then we started having the Vulcans tell us what to do, right? Now, is there a chance that would occur? Yeah, maybe. Maybe the Greys show up. Maybe the Reptiles show up. Maybe the Anunnaki show back up. Whatever. And they start saying, okay, guys, we got rules in space. Now, if that were to ever occur, obviously we would honor those rules because I'm assuming they could police them quite well. My hunch is that maybe we get to do this all by ourselves, which means the more responsible we are with our proliferation in space, the more privileges we would get when we are discovered by someone else to say, wow, you guys had enough forethought to be polite about the universe. You didn't mess anything up. You didn't go to planets and tear them to shreds and say, oh, I don't want this planet anymore. And you go to the next one, right? But now let's put the final cap on this thing, which is an unfortunate reality that could exist, okay? What if they're just bad guys out in space, like your Klingons, right? Now, from their perspective, they're not bad guys. But let's just say we wander into their territory, and they're pissed off. And they come at us before they ever talk to us. They just come right at us. And we forgot to do one thing. We forgot to create weapons of any kind. Wouldn't that be a sad thing that we'd have to develop to explore space, is to go around with weapons on our ship. And then as soon as we show up, people are freaked out because we have a whole arsenal of destructive things. Now, maybe by sheer force, we're able to actually keep weapons off of our ship. They can't destroy us. They shoot a laser at us, but because we control ether, we bounce that off of our ship. We just turn the ship up really high. Okay? But now, we've been discovered. They're on us. We're on their galactic radar system, right? I'll get back to communication in a second, but how can we escape? Can we escape in such a way that we don't leave an ethereal wave of where we've been? If you needed to chase a boat on a lake, it's pretty easy. Just follow the ripples of the engine, right? You'd have to find a way to go stealth. You have to find a way to just disappear, somehow drift away, so as when you finally take off, you're behind a moon and they can't see it and you get away, right? My thought is they've probably been there a lot longer than us and they figured out a lot of this stuff already. So we'd have to have some sort of peacekeeping situation. Again, what if the trillionaire licensed the technology 100 years into this program of traveling the universe and he has really bad ideas about what to do to Earth? Or he wants to take over a planet that he likes more than you do, and it's a long ways away. It's on the edge of the galaxy and he's just going to pummel the crap out of your sovereign land. Ooh, brother. You got to play the scenario out to protect yourself, right? So the thing I was going to say about communication, which I meandered away from, was that we would need a methodology of communicating back to Earth, wouldn't we? Now, in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, they have a beautiful phrase called the sub-ether wave net. And it's essentially, it never defines what it is. And of course, Star Trek has several versions of this as well. But usually every science fiction platform out there that tells stories has some form of communicating with Earth or their home base fairly quickly. Now, Star Trek was actually fairly, moderate in their development technology, which was, a mechanism to create great storytelling where they would send a message back to Earth, but it was going to take a long time to get to Earth. When you watch Voyager, and I guess they're, 75 light years away from Earth, I think, maybe 75,000, I can't remember. They're really far away. It's going to take 30 years or something to get home. They can't even send a message back to Earth. It's going to get there before they're all dead and they're on to the next generation on the ship. If I remember that correctly, it's something like that. So we would have to find some methodology of using ethereal winds, because if that's the fundamental particle in the universe and there's nothing smaller, then we're going to have to figure out a way to create some sort of binary data transmission over this fabric. And we're going to want to make it fairly accurate back to our planet and not back to a bunch of other planets that might telegraph where we are in the universe, creating further problems for us, right? So think about another subdivision. One division's making the spaceship. One division's making the outer spaceship traveling system. One is making the inner spaceship traveling system. One division is completely assigned to the gravity plate that's going to keep us alive. The other one's just trying to create a spaceship that can house all of our food and our supplies and make it fully autonomous. There's the little tiny ships that are going to go straight to the moon and come back. There's the ones that are going to go deeper into our solar system. And then there's the galactic one that's going to go over the galaxy. But someone's going to have to create all the other stuff. The communication system. This was all done when the Saturn or the Apollo project, came into fruition to get to the moon, which on this show we don't believe actually occurred. But at least they theorized something, right? I think it's the 4-second delay to send a message to the moon and back that was one of the biggest foul-ups they did in a lot of the communications with the astronauts when they were on the moon. And Richard Nixon makes the phone call, sort of a joke. He's getting responses under 4 seconds, right? But this is real. We want this to work, don't we? Consequently, I heard an interesting fact. I think back in the 80s, they said they wanted to figure out how much vegetation needed to be on a spaceship such that it would account for one human being's breathing. It was an infinite supply. What it created and what you breathed was one-to-one correlation, right? And I think that the number was astonishingly low. I think it was an Omni magazine article, and some of you might laugh because it's sort of a fun little rag back in the 80s. But they said that a 10-foot square healthy patch of grass was enough to create oxygen for one human being. Now, of course, you would probably insulate that a little bit with the algorithm just in case your grass died for some reason. But I truly believe we could synthesize oxygen out of some machine. We could do that on an atomic level since it's fairly primitive elements we're working with there. Especially if we could travel through the stars, wouldn't you think? But now imagine, in closing, imagine that every university around the world, from Caltech to some little junior college in the Midwest, the science teachers were to loosen up a little bit on their this is true, this is false, you know, paradigms. Let's say they were to allow in the conversation that there is ether in the universe, right? Basically invite the students to say, look, if you found a theory out there in the world, you're welcome to bring it in. But over the next year of this class, we're going to create a side project. You need to learn physics. You need to learn cosmology or whatever, astrophysics or whatever it is you're in school for. But there's going to be a project that this university is going to get behind. And we're going to fund it for 10 years. And every single student that comes through is welcome to contribute to it. But we are going to all create in our own little group our theory of how to get to the moon, to the all the planets, the stars. This whole program I've discussed on this show starts to become an individual program at every single college. And then through the notation and the mission statement of this project, we embed in it transparency. We start practicing transparency for the very first time. So instead of Caltech hoarding all the most brilliant people in the world away from, say, again, some junior college in Kansas or something, it's all freely distributed. Cambridge does it. Oxford does Oxford does it. You know, MIT does it. Everyone does it around the world. In Russia, in India, everywhere in the world. And we say this. We go, look, if you violate the transparency clause, you're out of the program. You're cut off. Everything that you have is seized. You're not allowed to have the project anymore. Some huge penalty of being cut out of the program if you violate the transparency. In fact, we come up with some new system of discovery. Everything is videotaped. Everything is put up for the world constantly. You can't walk into the facility and have a conversation in a boardroom or draw on a board, a whiteboard or whatever, without having it videotaped and put it directly out to the internet. We protect the feeds. If you want to read the feed, you're going to have to acknowledge who you are in this world. Now, we know there's a lot of spying that goes on and that kind of stuff, so it wouldn't probably be easy to police unless the governments themselves got behind it. But let me ask you this one little question here at the end of the episode. If that were to occur, if, like, what is it, Dr. Stephen Greer said, like I mentioned recently, if everyone got behind a zero-point energy project, how long would it take to create it? Or would we find it sitting on a shelf somewhere, sitting in the patent office somewhere, being protected and coveted, right? Now, if someone's heard of a theory and they go, look, I heard that if you do this and that, it works. And we find engine number one. And someone goes, yeah, you know, I heard that's old. Some defector out of some special project goes, you know what? Don't do that. Do this. And I know I'm supposed to be quiet about this for 20, 30 years of my whole life, whatever, been gagged, but screw it. This and this and this and this. And obviously, we have predators who will try to use that and weaponize it and dominate the planet with it. That's why we have to be vigilant as citizens with this information. I don't have all the answers. I think it's just fascinating. I have this gut feeling that if we could get on the same program together and harvest everything that's currently above board, that's ever been above board at any point in time, it's obviously a lot of things have been deprecated that are still true, I think we would have this solved potentially if a child was born today and they lived 80 years. They would be able to travel on this ship and at least get to everything in our solar system. Easy. Food for thought. Hopefully you feel me. If you haven't been to deepthoughtsradio.com, please go. There's audio, video, a locked Facebook group, and a Patreon page. For those of you who support me in any way, shape, or form, thank you so much. Please put your thoughts and observations down below, as Mr. What is it? Lionel Nation says. I think that's a brilliant statement. But until then, take care of yourself and someone else, and I will see you in the next Deep Thoughts. Over and out.